Shrink Wrap Radio number 309, Parental Strategies for Coping with Cyberbullying, with Holly Kenley.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Holly Kenley, and we're going to be discussing her advice to parents about preventing cyberbullying and coping with it when it does occur. Holly Kenley, M.A., is a California licensed marriage and family therapist. She holds a master's degree in psychology with an emphasis in marriage, family, and child counseling. She's worked in a variety of settings, a woman's shelter, a counseling center, and in private practice. Counseling with adolescents, teens, young, and older adults, Holly's areas of training and experience include sexual trauma, abuse, addiction, codependency, domestic violence, betrayal, and cyberbullying. Holly is the author of numerous published articles, and in 2010, she authored her second book, Breaking Through Betrayal and Recovering the Peace Within. Recently released are two e-singles, Betrayal Proof Your Relationship, What Couples Need to Know and Do, and Cyberbullying No More, Parenting a High-Tech Generation. In addition to her work as a therapist and as an author, Holly enjoys speaking at workshops and conferences. In addition to speaking to a variety of audiences for the past 2 years, Holly has been a peer presenter at the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists annual conference, speaking on the topics of betrayal and cyberbullying. At the 2012 annual conference, Holly will again address the issue of cyberbullying with an emphasis on protection, intervention, and prevention. Prior to and during her career as a therapist, Holly taught for 30 years in public education. Now, here's the interview. Holly Kenley, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It is so good to be with you again.
Yeah, I probably should say welcome back, because in June 2010, I interviewed you for my Wise Counsel podcast on surviving betrayal. And now you've written what you call an e-single on cyberbullying. And I've never encountered the term e-single before. What's an e-single?
To my knowledge, David, it is, there's an approximate word limit. I think, at least with my publisher, he likes to try to keep them under about 20,000 words and keep it concise, easy, accessible. They can be, I have a hard copy as well, but they also can be, of course, downloaded online. So it's concise, it's short, it's brief, to the point. And as I said, there usually is a word limit involved.
So it's more having to do with your publisher, say, than with Amazon or Kindle or something like that?
Well, right. But I think that if I again, am aware of this and know about it correctly, that it's kind of seems to be the way that the market is moving, that there is such a demand for shorter pieces. You know, how consumers want it really quickly and want to get it and absorb it and take it in. And so these smaller pieces seem to be kind of what I'm sensing is the way that a lot of publications are going.
Yeah, interesting. We're talking about cyber, and one of the cyber effects, I think, is shorter attention spans combined with information overload, that there's just so much out there to digest that's of interest, that I think we've all had to figure out ways to kind of shorten up, speed up, skim.
Yes.
maybe it's not all to the good, but that's definitely where it's going. So you've written this piece, and it is a kind of a short form piece about cyberbullying. And I'm wondering, how did you get interested in the topic of cyberbullying?
I have worked primarily, David, in my clinical work in the areas of abuse and trauma, very focused in on all kinds of betrayal, obviously, with the other book that I wrote. And so when I first started really paying attention to this and hearing about it about, around 2005, 2006, what I was hearing really resonated with me because it seemed like a form of abuse. Certainly a form of betrayal when this kind of abuse was on the internet and so difficult to get it down if indeed it could be taken down, and just ongoing injury and harm to the individual. In 2006, the media really picked up on it with some high-profile cases. One in particular was Meghan Meyer, a young girl who took her own life as a result of chronic and ongoing bullying.
Yes,
so really
I think I remember reading
more at that time. And then there were other tragedies that have occurred. In 2010, again, there were two very high-profile cases. Phoebe Prince was one, another young girl who took her own life. And I think the thing that was tragic in and of itself, but what really struck me as I was reading about it and started doing some in-depth research, is that individuals went on to her website, her memorial website page, and defamed her on that site, wrote horrific words on there. I just start asking myself, what is going on? What is happening with the human condition that individuals would think, you know, so little of an individual to do this? Then the very high-profile case of Tyler Clementi in 2010, the freshman at Rutgers University, who took his own life, a talented violinist who jumped off the George Washington Bridge as a result of being outed by his roommate on the internet.
My goodness.
And so, David, I just feel that with traditional bullying and cyberbullying, that we are really at a crossroads, that, you know, for one individual to take his or her own life is horrific, and now to have a series, you know, multiple deaths because of this. What I'm going to share today is going to be difficult to hear, and perhaps already is. Over 160,000 kids stay home every day from school, and that's according to the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty of Children in an article out of the New Yorker April 2nd.
160,000.
So in my opinion, this is just one of our most challenging issues right now, and we must find out what is going on and pay attention to it and intervene.
How do we define cyberbullying?
David, I would like to read to you a definition, and this is from Smith et al., and it's from the Journal of Child Psychiatry and Psychology and Psychiatry, and she and her colleagues have done extensive research on cyberbullying. The name of the article was Cyberbullying, Its Nature and Impact in Secondary School Pupils. I read this about 3 years ago, and that's it really struck me, and I want to read it and say why it's important.
Okay.
Cyberbullying is an aggressive, intentional act carried out by a group or individual using electronic forms of contact repeatedly and over time against a victim who cannot easily defend him or herself. Now, when I first read that, again, it really struck me because working in the areas of abuse, trauma, domestic violence, all kinds of betrayal, that's a definition that I would utilize in assessing, diagnosing, and treating all kinds of abuse. And it's important because even though it's getting better, there's more attention being given to this issue, is that for many individuals, adults and parents, it's minimized. The victim comes forward, they're not believed, it's diminished, it's not validated, it's minimized. It's just childhood behavior, it will go away, it will get better. And it is indeed, in my opinion, and is supported by the research, a form of abuse, and it needs to be assessed and treated as such.
I suspect that many parents feel helpless if a child comes home and says, well, I'm being bullied at school, talking about regular bullying now rather than cyberbullying. If a child comes home and says, well, so-and-so bullies me, some parents might dismiss it or minimize it, as you suggest, I suspect others just might feel kind of helpless. Well, like, what can I do?
Absolutely. They do feel helpless. And unfortunately, sometimes what is done with traditional or cyberbullying is that, you know, with cyberbullying, and they'll say, well, let's take away the technology, let's, you know, have you not use it, and then the behaviors go unchecked. And, you know, parents do try to take steps to protect their children, but if the perpetrators aren't held, you know, as we know, held accountable for their behaviors, the children continue to be victimized. I don't know if you have seen or heard about the movie Bully, that which just released within the past several weeks.
Yeah, it's in my neighborhood, and it's on my to-do list. I haven't seen it yet, or I might wait until it comes out on Netflix, which I suspect won't be very long.
Yes, it is absolutely, it's one of the most difficult things, films I've ever watched, but it really, really is an eye-opening to what is going on with our young people today, and how ineffective the interventions are, even in a systemic way.
Yeah. Now, are there synonyms for cyberbullying? Let's say somebody wanted to find out more, they wanted to Google it. Are there other search terms that a person should use?
There are so many, David. Some of them are like e-bullying, text bullying, mobile bullying. Two of the most common terms are social cruelty, and another very common term used among youth today is social combating. And one of the reasons it's so important, because very much like a batterer or a perpetrator of abuse, when cyber bullies or traditional bullies are questioned, they will, you know, use those defense mechanisms and denial and say, well, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not involved in cyberbullying. And so you have to really have that vocabulary under your belt and say, well, you know, are you involved in e-bullying? Well, no. Mobile bullying, no. Are you involved in social cruelty? Well, kind of, what do you mean? Are you involved in social combating? Well, yes, but everybody does that. So we absolutely need to have the vocabulary under our belts when we're working with victims or bullies.
Well, I have the impression that with non-cyber bullies, that research has shown that these are often kids or people who were bullied themselves or the victims of some kind of parental bullying. And so it kind of gets transferred. And I'm wondering if that same model, first of all, do you share that impression? And secondly, does that fit the profile for cyberbullying, or is the situation different for cyberbullying?
What I've uncovered in the research, David, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that there can always be pre-existing conditions or underlying factors, pathology. Of course, we understand that there can be abuse in the home and those kinds of things. When there is an incredibly strong correlation between individuals who are involved in either cyberbullying or who are being targeted, who are cyber victims, and are also involved in traditional bullying or traditional victimization. So, for example, if I have a cyber victim who has come in, one of the things that's really important is to assess the role and make sure that this is what they call a pure victim. Because many cyber victims, after, you know, weeks or months or chronic ongoing targeting and victimization, eventually do start to retaliate out of just need to survive. And so we call that a cyber bully victim. So it's really, really important to find out their history and their role and their involvement in both as a victim and a bully. And also to see if they are involved in bullying or victimization in the traditional way as well. And there is that strong correlation.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the statistics on bullying, on kids staying home from school. I think you said 160,000 because they're they're being bullied at school. Do we know anything about the prevalence of cyberbullying and who's at risk?
Yes, we do, David. Samir Hinduja and Justin Patchen, two individuals that have written a couple of outstanding books and do an incredible amount of work with schools. And according to them, one in five children will be a victim of cyberbullying in his or her lifetime. That's a very conservative estimate because victims are hesitant to report. Worldwide, according to other researchers, it varies from 10 to 42%. Any country, most developed countries, if not all, who with individuals that have access to technology and utilize it, the victimization rates range from 10 to 42%. And that's very, I know that there's a range there and there's several reasons why there's such a discrepancy there, a wide range. And it's one of the reasons because we don't have a consistent definition for cyberbullying. And there's some other reasons as well. It crosses all socioeconomic, racial, ethnic, cultural boundaries, and gender boundaries as well. The only exception to equality and victimization is that our special needs population and our GLTB population are very much more highly targeted.
And one of the things that interests me is that evidently it's not unique to the United States. Somehow it's easy to get down on our own selves and our own country. But if I understand you correctly, you're saying it's pretty universal.
It absolutely is, David. And when I started really digging in, doing some research over, well, it's been about 3 years now, I only hit the tip of the iceberg. I looked at research from about 15 to 20 different countries. So it's worldwide.
Wow. Wow. I'm thinking about Mean Girls right now and some of the movies that have depicted girls in particular. And I'm sure it's not unique to girls being the only bullies, but I guess I've seen a couple of films in which they've pretty forcefully brought that point across.
Yeah, some of the initial research that I did, and it was pretty consistent, is that there seemed to be girls that seemed to peak more in social, or excuse me, relational aggression, and then, and especially right around middle school, but then as they aged, it pretty much evened out. I mean, there really wasn't a discrepancy between females and males. It was pretty consistent.
You've broken down the piece that you wrote into three main categories: protection, intervention, and prevention. So maybe we can move through those and let's talk about protection.
Protection, David, when I talk about this to audiences, I tell them that it's really important that when we talk about protection, especially with cyberbullying, that we are looking at ways to lower the risk of cyber harm, because the bottom line is as soon as an individual has access to technology and is utilizing it, that individual is at risk. So we, you know, these are going to protect you, but they're not going to prevent cyber abuse or cyber harm. I think one of the most important things that I share with parents and with audiences is that we don't do a very good job in preparing our children to utilize their technology. When I think about all the things that we do to prepare a young person to drive, the practice time, the training time, the education, the written test, the driving test, and additional benchmarks that sometimes, according to the state, you know, children have to go through before they can actually get their keys and drive. We go through so much preparation, you know, to protect them, to educate them and protect them. And yet we do so little when we hand over a laptop or a cell phone to a youngster in really educating them and teaching them how to navigate through the cyber world. And so we really, really need to do a much better job. And I tell parents or audiences two things. One, and there's so many parts to this, but basically, one, know why you're giving a young person a piece of technology. For example, maybe you're giving a young child a cell phone. That's, you know, for safety. That's understandable. So that's why. And now, how are they to utilize it? Can they text on it? Can they call on it? How are you going to teach them and show them what to use it for and how to use it? So, you know, these are just two general rules that I share and write about. The other thing is, on my website and in my materials, there is parents don't think about this, or adults or guardians, but it's so important to have what we call a family online internet safety contract, where it's adults and children agreeing to participate in certain behaviors as far how they're going to access and utilize their technology. And that might sound really strange, but again, think about the risk that we're putting our young people at, and all this is to protect them.
It's really fascinating. My kids are adults now, and so they were before the big sort of distribution of cell phones, you know, just becoming so widespread. Now, if I go to a mall or something, I see really little kids with cell phones, and I would think that many times, if not mostly, there's probably not a whole lot of thought process other than what I would imagine peer pressure. I can remember when my kids were in school, you know, and they had to have a certain brand of jeans, or they had to have a certain kind of brand of tennis shoes because everybody else had them and they would be on the outs. And so as a parent, we didn't always cave, but you know, certainly you're sensitive to that, and you don't want your kid to be in the out group. So I could see that, you know, that a lot of parents might just give their kids a phone due to peer pressure.
Absolutely. And that is one of the problems and one of the difficulties that parents deal with. I was talking with a group of psychology students at Cal State University in the desert area a couple weeks ago, and they were mainly juniors and psychology majors, and we were talking about this topic, and one of the students in the class, he said, you know, Holly, I think that parents today use the technology as a pacifier. And I said, mm-hmm. Oh, really? You know, this is interesting hearing it coming from him. And he said, yeah, it's just a convenient babysitter. It keeps them very entertained. And so I do think peer pressure is part of it. You know, I trust that this young man had some reason behind what he was saying. But I think, yes, we do cave in and give in so readily without even thinking about the dangers that are there. And so that's where the education piece comes in.
Yeah. You know, another fascinating thing that emerged as I was reading what you had written was that in times past, parents have been very diligent and still, I'm sure, about trying to protect their children from being victimized by strangers. You know, don't take candy from a stranger. Don't get into a car if some older person comes and, you know, tries to lure you into their car, etc. But the phenomenon of cyberbullying is from people you know, and usually from your own peer group, more or less.
Yes, That's the piece, David, that really it troubles me so much, and that's why I was so interested in really looking at causation and what is going on. I would like to add, just speaking of that, because so many times it is from someone that you know, that a little saying that is something that is so easy to apply. It's a little saying. It's called stop, save, and share. And just for parents, guardians, adults, anyone, is that we want to tell our children, just like you said, when you don't want to approach a stranger, if any harm, anything uncomfortable comes across the cyber waves through a text, an email, whatever it is, if it feels uncomfortable, unsafe, is to stop and do not respond, save and print it out. You may be able to use it and, you know, legally or just as, you know, as a piece of something that can help you to take some steps in protecting your child. And then to tell a trusted adult. You know, so many victims, just like victims of abuse and trauma, do not come forward because they're so fearful of retaliation. So you really, really want individuals to know that they're to stop and not respond, save and print it out, and tell a trusted adult. Very important protective measure.
Yeah, those sound like excellent guidelines. And the parents have a dual responsibility because maybe they have a child who's being victimized, but it's also possible that their child is a victimizer. And everybody thinks that their child is a little angel, but it's possible that their child is actually involved in some bullying. Maybe even some, quotes, nice children from nice families get caught up in bullying.
Absolutely. That's as I mentioned a little bit ago, that many times victims do become what we call a bully victim because they're at this frustration level and scared and frightened and don't know where to go or don't know where to get help. Don't believe that anybody can do anything or will do anything, even if they do tell, which is sometimes the case. So we really need to pay attention. There are reasonable, at low level cyberbullying and cyber victimization, there are some you know, reasonable measures that parents can do to intervene and, you know, stop it before it escalates. It typically escalates very quickly, and I don't just mean in severity, but I mean in the terms of how I call, not, they're not really bystanders, but cyber standards, that the number of other individuals that can come on board and add to the victimization.
Yeah, Holly, I'm not sure you caught my comment. I was actually referring to victimizers rather than victims, to the kids who are victimizers, and how do parents get cued into that, and what do they do about their kid who is victimizing others?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, I did misunderstand just a little bit. If a child is bullying, is perpetrating harm onto another individual, and if the audience doesn't hear anything else that I say today, this is really important, is the technology is not the problem, it's the behavior. And typically what parents do, either with victims or bullies, is that they ground them from the technology or take the technology away. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be monitoring it or supervising it or maybe even having a time out from it just as they're watching and observing and supervising their behavior online. But with a victimizer, with a perpetrator, with a bully, is that what we want to do, and I just tell them the three C's, is that there should be behavioral consequences, reasonable consequences in place that really bring them to an understanding of what their behaviors are doing, with the impact that they are having on the individual. And that's why I said maybe a timeout, or better yet, supervising and monitoring their technology, because the number one fear of a bully is having their technology taken away or having it monitored. So we do want to put technological interventions in place, monitoring it, supervising it, putting in tracking software, whatever we need to do there. Secondly, if there should be a family internet contract in place, something that's going to hold this individual accountable for her behavior, his or her behaviors online. And again, I alluded to that contract earlier. And then thirdly, and perhaps even most importantly, is that there should be some type of counseling, some type of discussion about what the person, why the person is doing this, what needs are getting met from it, and doing whatever can be done in counseling, whether it be anger management or group counseling, to find out and to tap into this person's needs and voids and why they're, what their motivations are, and getting them to an understanding as to how their behaviors are impacting and injuring another individual. very important.
Well, speaking of motivations, are there certain characteristics of cyber victims and of cyber bullies?
Yes, there are. When in a study done out of Turkey, and it was assessing the psychological needs as predictors, the victims were scored high, and it makes sense, on needing and wanting friendship, safety, belonging, and acceptance. Typically, victims, not always, but very often, David, they are very low in their social skills. Again, there's a high percentage of individuals special needs who are often victimized and don't have maybe those same social skills as other kids. They tend to be more isolated, more loners, more introverted. And so they are seeking out friendship. And so they're spending time online seeking out that need for affiliation and friendship. So those are some of the characteristics. Again, there can be other underlying disorders or predispositions, so we don't want to negate that. With our cyberbullies, when they were assessed in the same study, no surprise, they scored very high on aggression and succurrence. In other words, that this need to befriend another individual, but to sucker them into really helping to fulfill their own needs and desires, kind of a manipulation type of need or want. There was also needs for power and control, domination, and a desire to hurt and harm others, that just innate desire to want to do that. So, also, it was so disturbing and hard, David, many cyberbullies said that they did it for fun, that it was cool, that everyone did it, and so, we don't want to disregard that component as well.
Yeah, you've talked about a link or a similarity between cyberbullying and domestic violence. What are you thinking of there?
What really has struck me, David, is that one, because I work so much with victims, is that their reluctance to report, they're undergoing, long periods of chronic and ongoing abuse, trauma, stress, and blaming themselves. They feel ashamed, guilty, embarrassed. Don't feel like it's, as I mentioned a minute ago, that it's going to get any better, that anybody can help them. And then you can imagine, as I said, with the cyberbullying, with so many other cyber standards coming on board and victimizing them, feel very alone and isolated. So they have very much the persona and the symptomology and characteristics of an abuse victim. At least that's what my experience has been. PTSD, depression, anxiety, a lot of those kinds of symptomology. And then with the perpetrators, the cyber bullies, they tend to kind of have those same kind of characteristics as a perpetrator of domestic violence. Again, I'm talking about extreme cases here where there is a lot of, obviously, aggression, dominance, a lot of denial, defensiveness, narcissism, antisocial personality disorder. So there's those commonalities there that I've seen.
Interesting. Are there any particular therapeutic approaches that have been found to be successful in addressing these kinds of aggressive behaviors associated with cyberbullying and victims?
In so much of the research, David, and I've had to pull together a lot as far as therapeutically, because there's a lot of really good information out there for schools. There isn't a tremendous amount yet, in the therapeutic field. But when I'm reading through it and analyzing and evaluating it, as I've said, it falls under this arena of abuse and trauma and aggression. And there seems to be a lot of consensus, at least with the programs that have shown incredible success in countries like Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom, Canada, is, especially with the aggressors, is to get them into group work, interpersonal group work,
mm-hmm.
Because we want to tap into what those needs are, those aggressive needs, and get them to, tapping into how their behaviors are affecting other individuals and really getting into the concept of having empathy for
exactly.
another individual.
Yes.
I did a lot of reading and studying of Albert Bandura's theory of moral disengagement because to me, I don't know how much time we can spend on that, but in that theory about that there is this disconnect between an individual, this is kind of in a nutshell, an individual and what his or her behaviors are doing to another individual, is that what we want to do is reconnect individuals and get them, tapping them into, again, that their behaviors are causing injury and harm to another individual. It was interesting, David, in a study that I came across out of Singapore, what they were actually, their hypothesis is that they felt that the nature of cyberspace may actually facilitate both low affective and cognitive empathy in individuals. And the studies were also, the results were comparable to additional studies in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. And what their part of their conclusion was is that the anonymity of the cyberbullying provides,
yes.
Through the cyber networks provides, actually reduces an individual's sensitivity towards his or her surroundings. And this, with reduced social cues, actually facilitated a dip in both cognitive and affective empathy. So getting back to your question, is group work, restorative justice, getting into interpersonal approaches that reconnect individuals and the feelings of one another.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. I was thinking empathy would be the way to go. And also, I was thinking about anonymity, and I was remembering when the World Wide Web first came into existence, which I can remember, and the beginnings of email. And one of the phenomena that everybody noticed, you didn't have to be a social scientist, was called flaming, where people would you send these awful emails to one another and post awful inflammatory things, you know, in their web posts. And it's something about the anonymity there, that people would say things that they would never say to another person in person.
Absolutely, David. The anonymity is a huge piece in this. And it actually frees up an individual, and you're distant from the target. You are detached from the target, and the phenomenon of disinhibition, where most often, if not very often, there's very little, if any, supervision. And we know that human beings behave differently when they're not being monitored or supervised. And so that anonymity, as you just were saying, it frees up the individual to behave in ways that he or she would not normally behave. And because there are no repercussions, there are no feedback loops, there's no one to step in to rectify the inappropriateness of the behavior, it actually is reinforced through the technology itself.
Yes. Now, we've talked about the first two of your three major areas I can't think of what the right word would be, but we've talked about protection and intervention. I wonder if we've covered prevention yet, or if you have more to say about prevention. You know, as a social phenomenon, I guess I'm wondering, are there things that we can do on a societal level or school level, family level? What can we do in terms of prevention?
There really, David, is so much that we can do, and I think a couple of things that are just really important is that no one individual or component of society is going to be able to change this or to fix it. You know, we would all, I think, like an easy solution to this, but it has to be systemic. As a former teacher, a public school teacher for 30 years, I know how frustrating it was when oftentimes, and not that the school shouldn't do their piece in it, they absolutely should, but many times the schools were looked at to solve or to fix the social ills of that time period.
Right.
And they haven't done a really good job because they have so many other things that they're required to do.
Sure.
And so I think the first thing is that parents, adults, the guardians need to do their role. Young people need to be taught and educated and do their role. Schools, of course, need to do their role, but so do communities and organizations. We all need to have a conversation about it. We all need to become educated about it, about what we can do. And secondly, that leads to, you know, what is it? And I think, as I said, in order to prevent something, in my knowledge, in my brain, we have to look at causation. And given that there can be lots of other personas and symptomology and factors involved, that put aside, that what the research has shown me is that there is this disconnect among individuals. I read a quote, let me see if I have it in front of me, David, that when I first read this, it just astounded me, and it says, this is from Spears et al., another amazing researcher in this field, and she says, cyberbullying could be a normative component for contemporary relationships as individuals navigate and inhabit social networking worlds. Cyberbullying concerns the interruption to and breakdown of ordinary relationships, not just those of bully and victim. And I've come to the conclusion, I want to just focus on causation here for a minute, David, is
sure.
As our dependence upon and reliance upon electronic devices for communication and socialization increases, that cyberbullying is a symptom, a side effect, a consequence, if you will, of the slow erosion of the human empathic spirit.
Mm. That sounds very alarming.
I know.
I can't dispute it, unfortunately.
So how, I mean, if we can so easily send a text, send an email, write on somebody's memorial Facebook page, something horrific, something demeaning, something derogatory, if that comes so easily to us, what is missing inside of us? For me, it says empathy, and the research seems to be, you know, validating that, or I'm agreeing with the research, because I don't know how we can so easily harm another individual if we have empathy for one another.
Well, I think it's been noted that there seems to be a decline in what we might call civility, not just online, but in face-to-face mm-hmm. relationships.
Absolutely. And I do want to say, David, in the same breath, that I love technology. I use it a lot. And so I'm not suggesting, the research is not suggesting that we do away with it. There are so many amazing benefits. But what some of the experts are suggesting, and there's a really good book by Hanel and Trolley, or Trolley and Hanel, called Cyber Kids, Cyber Bullying, Cyber Balance. What they're saying is, you know, don't throw away the technology. That's ridiculous. But what we need to do is we need to have a balanced diet of direct and indirect communication and socialization. And David, think about it. When you look around at an airport or a restaurant or wherever you might be, everybody's heads and eyes are down.
Yes. Even you can see people with their kids. And
they're very down, and we don't
right.
look at each other very much anymore.
And children are getting less attention from their parents.
So to bring a balance back into our lives so that we are not just being, you know, the X and Y generation. There has only been raised on technology. And so we really need to, there's so much more to say about this, but it's just so important that we bring direct interaction back into our families, into our friendships, and into our communication and socialization in general.
Well, as you point out, there's so much more that could be said. As we sort of get near the winding down place here, I wonder if there's anything that you were hoping to say that you haven't had a chance to get out yet.
I think, David, just that this is such an important issue. What I've said that I know, but I really feel that if we don't start making changes now, that it's going to have even more disastrous effects. And it is so simple for all of us to begin changing our behaviors. Again, it's not the technology, it's our behaviors. Adults must model appropriate behavior. We must be the ones that show it, demonstrate it, model it, in order for our young people then to be making changes. You know, it was interesting, David, when I was talking to that group of students at Cal State University San Bernardino, one of the students said, you know, Holly, I wanted to talk to my professor about, you know, something that was going on in a class. And I went to him and he said, you know, just email me. And the student said, but I want to talk to you in person. I need to see you and I need to talk to you. And he said, well, I have email hours, you know, email me during that time. And she said, you know, Holly, I really think the schools are making it worse. And anyway, it was just so interesting because, again, the technology is so wonderful and we get amazing things from it, but we are losing the human connection. And when we stop being connected on that human empathic level, David, we stop being human. And I'm really worried. You're hearing my voice. And I just hope people will hear me and begin thinking about and begin changing their behaviors.
Well, you certainly are doing your part towards prevention. I know not only have you written this book, and I'll give people a link to it after we're off, but also the public speaking that you're doing is hopefully going to raise awareness. And I have to compliment you. I'm impressed by the personal research that you've done in terms of going to the literature and seeking out all of this information and synthesizing it. So good work and keep it up.
Thank you, David. I appreciate that. When I got into this, I had some ideas, but I did go into it with one really underlining motivation, and that was for not to let the research validate what I thought, but for me to find out what the research said, and I would move in that direction. So I really worked hard at that. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I can tell that you did, and good for you. So Holly Kenley, I want to thank you for being my guest again, this time on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it. Thanks again.
I hope those of you who are parents and or educators got some good tips here. I've never been bullied online, but I have received some nasty flame-type emails from time to time. For example, I have a series on YouTube about the Zodiac serial killer because of the book on that topic that I co-authored a few years ago. Some rude clod there made a comment that my hair looks crazy, that I look like Nick Nolte. And even though I know I shouldn't let it bother me, it did. And I actually started wearing a baseball cap to hide my hair on the subsequent episodes. Now I can just imagine how much more upsetting a prolonged deliberate campaign of cyber persecution would be on a young person who has not yet established a secure sense of identity. When looked at from that point of view, it's not surprising that some especially vulnerable young people would end up killing themselves or in other cases turn to homicide, as in Columbine and other mass school shootings. I did experience some bullying of the traditional type coming up as a kid. Fortunately, I survived it and was good at diverting it and also developing protective allies. As I was reflecting on this topic, I almost forgot about the impact of a bullying incident in college. I really never expected to encounter that sort of thing in college, of all places, and an Ivy League school at that. In fact, that one rather small incident had such a significant impact on my life that it was the focus of my third podcast here. If you've never heard it, you might want to go back and listen to Shrink Wrap Radio number 3 on victimhood, responsibility, and choice with Dr. Dave. And it's a conversation that I had with my longtime friend, Jerry Trumbull. For those of you who are Jerry Trumbull fans and you haven't heard it, I think you'll really enjoy it. Now, finally, I did tell Holly that I'd let you know about how to get her book. It's really more of a pamphlet, only 21 pages long. But as you heard, it's backed up by a lot of research on her part. You can find it on Amazon.com. And the title again is Cyberbullying No More by Holly Kenly. And Holly Kenly is spelled H-O-L-L-I. And Kenly is spelled K-E-N-L-E-Y. And of course, you'll find a link to her website if you go to our website, look at the show notes, and click on her name.
Dr. Dave knows how much his listeners are inspired by the podcast, and now there's an easy way to show your gratitude and at the same time ensure a constant stream of new, in-depth interviews. You can easily make a contribution by logging onto the website and clicking on the big green donate button. Your donation will make a difference. Dr. Dave thanks you all.
Thanks, Sherry West. And I do want to thank all who have clicked on that big green donate button, as well as those of you who I hope will do so. And once again, I want to call your attention to the fact that there are now a bunch of new, faster loading share buttons beneath each episode, or actually at the top on each episode on the website. So now if you go to the website, you'll find you can easily email a link to any given episode to your friends, and you'll also see buttons for sharing via your Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus. I've discovered I think you have to have joined Google Plus for you to give us a plus one, or maybe it's enough if you at least have a Gmail account. At any rate, I encourage you all to get a Google Plus account because it's really easy, doesn't cost you anything, and then we can do some interesting things with it. For example, this past week, we were able to have a group video chat using the Google Plus Hangouts feature that included Brandon Dennis from New Zealand, another Shrink Wrap Radio listener, Rao from Brazil, as well as a fellow in India, another in the Ivory Coast, another in Tunisia, and one in Texas. And we all enjoyed an interesting conversation for about an hour and a half. So join the fun. Get your G Plus or Google Plus account, and then click on the G Plus button in the right-hand sidebar, which should allow you to follow Shrink Wrap Radio there. Also, at the bottom of the right-hand sidebar, you'll find links that you can click on that will take you to our Facebook fan group page, which I know many of you are already among my friends there. And there's also a link to my new Facebook Shrink Wrap Radio page, which is a great place for you to give us lots of likes. Presumably, this will help us to rank higher in the search engines, and we do want everyone seeking psychology-related podcasts to find us. And while you're down there on the bottom of our right-hand sidebar, you'll also find a link to our Yahoo discussion group, which is moderated by listeners Reinhard and Brandon Dennis. Brandon's brought some good new energy to that group as our new co-facilitator. I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript on the site. It's number 297, Engineering Happiness with Rakesh Sarin, PhD. So thank you to the transcriptionists for that, and all you other transcriptionists out there who signed on for one or other episode, please keep plugging away or let me know if you've changed your mind. Also, as you may recall, that last time I announced Heather Gout's free sci-fi ebook, which she hopes you will all download and enjoy. I heard from Dr. Ralph Wilson that he couldn't find it on the smashwords.com website that I mentioned before, and I couldn't find it either. So I recontacted Heather to get the URL and found I was able to download it in Kindle format, among other formats, and so I've now got access to it on my iMac, my iPhone, and my iPad using the Kindle app. I've posted the URL in the comments area for episode number 308, the one about my long run of synchronicities. So look for that URL there in the comments area. Finally, I got the following email requesting that I make an announcement here, and it seemed a reasonable request, so here it is. The person writes, "My name is Chrissy, and I am the casting producer for TLC's My Strange Addiction. This show is a docuseries about men and women with uncommon addictions and obsessions, and provides the people being profiled with an opportunity to explore and open up about their behavior, as well as seek help from a professional who can help them dig a bit deeper into their addiction, obsession, or compulsive behavior." And she puts in parentheses, "The term addiction is used with some freedom." She goes on, "I wanted to reach out to you and ask if you might be willing to make an announcement on your radio blog about our show. We are currently casting for a new season, looking for men and women who might like to share their uncommon addictions and trying to spread the word. If you could help us out by spreading the word of our casting call and directing people to email us at casting@20west.tv. That's casting@20west.tv. For more information, I would greatly appreciate it." So there, we made the announcement.
This is Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Hi, this is Patricia Damery, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
No, that was not a mistake, playing two different transitions back to back. Rather, it's indicative of the fact that the next episode will feature two guests. More about that in a bit. First, let's hear what our listener community has to say. And we start with a very moving recorded message posted by Brandon in New Zealand.
Wow, what a last podcast you did, Dr. Dave. That was amazing on synchronicities and your search for your father. I decided to record this and send it to you for something a little bit different than emailing you. I was really moved by that recording that you did, to a point where I was actually listening to the recording in the car and had to pull over because I was moved to tears. It really resonated with my search for my father and the losses that I experience around that. And in fact, I'd like to share a psychological phenomena where when my daughter was 2 years old, and it was my first child, I went through a lot of emotional problems around feeling insecure around my daughter, fearful of losing her, and would take this to my therapist, and we'd talk about that, and that my father left me when I was two, and eventually my therapist encouraged me to talk to my mother about who. I have a pretty strange relationship with my mother, but anyway, I spoke to her about it, and she said, no, you weren't 2 years old, you were 10 months old when he left. And as soon as she told me that, all the anxiety dropped out. But of course, with my second child, when he turned 10 months old, all that familiar anxiety popped up again for me. But anyway, this is not the main reason for recording this. But last night I had a series of dreams, and you were in I think the first two, and I don't normally dream about you. What were they about? They were, it's escaping my mind now, but that's not really why I'm recording this. It was the last dream I had prior to waking up, was that I dreamt of my father, and I've never dreamt of my father before. And in the dream, I was incredibly angry at him, and I was throwing glass jars and cups, bowls at him. I was really violent, swearing at him and telling him to get out of my home. I eventually called the police to try to get them to remove him, and I was willing to lie to the police to say that he assaulted me so they would come around and remove him. But in my dream, I kept on hanging up for some reason, or they would hang up, and it was getting really frustrating. Anyway, I woke up and I decided to share this dream with my partner, and I'm not one to share dreams with my partner, but I felt compelled to. And as I was telling the dream, she was going, "Oh my God, oh my God." And I said, "What?" And she said that she too had dreamt of my father, and she too had never dreamt of my father before. And in her dream, she was trying to get him out of the house, and she was telling him that he didn't deserve to be around myself or his grandchildren. And she was getting goosebumps, and actually so was I a bit from that. And that's why I'm recording this and giving it to you, just letting you know that, you know, you talk about a full circle, but there's kind of like an echo that then touches on other people maybe listening in, and then the dreaming has, I guess, stirred something in me and then my partner. We've never dreamt the same dreams before. Don't quite know what to make of it. Synchronicity sounds like a good name to tag to it. And I just want to thank you, Dr. Dave, for bringing this podcast to my attention. I've noticed that your recordings have been really useful for my personal development as well as my educational or career development. When I first started listening to your podcast, I was just working in a mental health library, and I just wanted some podcasts to direct people to as a library resource, but I ended up getting more hooked into it than any of my borrowers. And I decided I wanted to change my direction more to a therapeutic standing, and hence since then I've done my diploma in counselling and now doing training in process-oriented psychology through Australia, and want to do some trauma counselling and training as well. And I owe it to you. I know I have my own journey, but you've really, your podcasts have been invaluable for bringing insight and direction in my life. And I thank you so much, and thank you so much for your last podcast. It was incredibly moving. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Wow. I have to say, I appreciate this feedback from Brandon on so many different levels. First of all, I was a little nervous about putting my own personal story about my search for my biological father up on the podcast. Was it just totally self-indulgent and or exhibitionistic to share all that with the world? Yet on balance, my intuition was telling me that it might touch others in some way. And so this message from Brandon, as well as comments and emails from others, reinforces that for me. And then the amazing synchronicity of Brandon and his partner both having a dream about his father with similar content and on the same night, and this in response to listening to an episode that was all about synchronicity. Yes, I would also call that synchronicity as well. And of course, I'm also very touched by the way Brandon has made use of these podcasts to move forward and enhance his own personal and professional life. And as a podcaster and communicator, I couldn't ask for more. Longtime listener and supporter Joan in Australia wrote, "Hi, David, I want to thank you for overcoming your reluctance to tell so much of your own story. I really appreciate hearing you share such precious life experiences, and it's been very thought-provoking to know about the way your perspective has developed over time, even to virtually the present moment. And then she goes on to let me know about a glitch that for a while was at the end of the last podcast. Now, I did go in and repair that, and hopefully you heard the repaired version. If you didn't, well, you didn't miss much. It only messed up the last minute or two, and you didn't miss anything important. And she concludes, did I mention this is a wonderful episode? Thank you again for being so open. Regards from Joe. And I'll take time to read one more here. And it starts, hello, Dr. Dave. I have an interview slash topic suggestion for either Shrink Wrap Radio or the Wise Counsel podcast. No more Wise Counsel, I'm afraid. She goes on to say, I would like to suggest that you cast an episode featuring systems-centered therapy, or SCT. This is a group therapy based on Ivan Agazarian's theory of living human systems. It's described as a method of reducing conflicts with oneself and others. You can find her and others' email contact info on this webpage. And it's basically systemscentered.com. And so you can go there and explore that. She goes on to say, about me and my experience in SCT, I am a client in individual and group psychotherapy, and I'm about to enter a clinical Master of Social Work program this fall. My individual therapist has both DBT, that's a dialectical behavior therapy, and SCT groups. And she describes SCT as an extension of DBT in regard to the mindfulness and interpersonal effectiveness aspects. Having been in an SCT group for about 5 months now, I would have to say I agree with her. SCT does a great job of honing right into one's old defensive patterns of communication in real time. It's based on exploring rather than explaining, observing physical sensations of emotion before analyzing them, undoing defenses gradually, connecting with oneself and then with others, learning to behave according to role, goal, and context, achieve a balance of discrimination and integration, and reduce noise in communication for greater authenticity and effectiveness. Group therapy is designed so that no one ever has to work alone. All feelings and thoughts, for example, mind reads, negative predictions, simple curiosity, they're all honored, and reality can be fully tested. Along the way, one discovers forks in the road that reveal that we truly do have a choice in how we think, how we feel, and it teaches one to disentangle thoughts from feelings and focus on one thing at a time. Although SCT can be very frustrating, I find it greatly rewarding and effective in helping to reduce my anxieties and improve my relationships with people in my everyday life. Maybe someday I'll become a practitioner of SCT myself, or if not, certainly I will utilize some of the aspects as the communication skills exercised by the therapist are easy to integrate into other types of group and individual therapy. Please consider featuring SCT as a podcast. Thank you so much for considering, and that's from Suzanne. Suzanne, thanks so much for bringing this to my attention. I have to admit that I had not previously heard of SCT, and it does sound like a wonderful approach, particularly given the detail with which you have described it to us. I appreciate that sharing. At the same time, I have to say I have received so many suggestions from listeners for great podcast guests, as well as I am approached directly now by authors of books and by their publicists who want to send me books. Plus, I have my own, you know, I like to follow my nose. So somehow who I end up interviewing, it turns out to be a mix of all these factors. And I appreciate the suggestions that people send, but also you will need to understand that I mean, there just isn't enough time to act on them all. There just isn't. I'm only doing one a week. And I also received a voicemail from someone who she did not identify herself, but she was suggesting a David Rico, who teaches at Spirit Rock, a meditation center near me. and who has written many books, including one about synchronicity. And so I've certainly added him as a possibility to my to-do list. So I want to thank her for that message. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave a voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And don't forget, you can go to the Apps tab on our site for information about getting our iPhone, iPad, iPod, /Android app, and you can contact me directly through that. Thanks to Holly Kenley for sharing her insights and recommendations on parental strategies for coping with cyberbullying.